Good morning, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay, and I am from Chicago, and I will be the host for the presentation this morning. Today is Sunday, August 11th, 2024. The share ID numbers for Friday, August 9th, for the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 21,644. That's 21,644. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, 21,645. That's 21,645. This morning, A Vision for You presents, Recovery is Not Dependent on People. So our speaker is going to share her personal experience about trudging the road of recovery despite adversity. And she's going to elaborate on the big book, specific big book reference, you know, job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking as long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. So paradox. Paradox, I think, is the beating heart of this spiritual program of action. You know, here's some examples I was thinking of about this type of paradox. You know, this is a we program. It is. And yet I must place my dependency on a higher power. You know, I'm powerless over food, yet I must, you know, put the food down. I need to put the food down before I embark on the steps. And just the idea that I'm absolutely powerless to solve this problem of my own accord, and yet it is action that's going to be the catalyst towards this process of spiritual restoration. You know, the idea of complete deflation and overcoming addiction refers to really to reaching a point where one acknowledges the full extent of their addiction's negative impact. And this leads to a deep sense of humility, surrender, willingness to change, let's hope it does. And it involves letting go of denial and egoism and false beliefs about control, which paved the way for true recovery and transformation. In the first foreword of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are introduced to the purpose of the text. It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. You know, the reason the big book carries so much weight is really quite simple to me. It provides the directions that will enable us to not only get well, but perhaps more importantly, to stay well. And the main goal, we understand the purpose, but the main goal of the textbook is to make it possible for the reader to find a power greater than himself to solve his problem. Now, we learn, of course, that we have what is defined as a spiritual malady. Well, what the heck is a malady? Well, a malady is a term. It refers to a disease or an ailment. It's kind of like a general feeling of unwell or unhealthy. So what I learn is that I am spiritually unwell. I'm spiritually unhealthy. You know, the implication being that if there was a way, some, I don't know, restorative means of recapturing spiritual health, we can recover. We can recover from this overwhelming condition of dis-ease. And, you know, let's face it, there was never a hopeless condition of mind and body. Rather, we're told that it was only seemingly hopeless. In other words, I sure seemed to be doomed, but there was unquestionably a way out, and it just appeared to me that I was without hope. So, you know, what's the way out for the alcoholic of the seemingly hopeless variety? Only one way, according to the text, at least for people like us. I must form a relationship with a power greater than myself. And we learn that we cannot access a relationship with this power by merely wanting the power, by desperately needing the power, nor can I be brought into relationship with this power through you know, sheer intention. In other words, I could pray for one. I could pray with all my heart, and we encourage that. I could meditate till the cows come home, you know, just sort of demonstrating my desire or intention to bring this power into my consciousness. And it simply, in my experience, won't happen. And I've heard many others say that as well, no matter how unfair I feel that is. The big book really is a call to action. It encapsulates the idea that divine providence or some sort of creative intelligence that is dynamic and it's and continually shaping our lives and circumstances when we're willing to take action, particularly as we're going to hear this morning in the face of, you know, heart, you know, changing adversity in the midst of the raging storm that brings us to our knees. There's lots of adversity. And perhaps in this respect, my higher power is going to provide the wind, but I have to raise the sails. You know, this underscores the notion that while divine, creative intelligence, this type of assistance may be presented to me, it's my responsibility to take action and make the most of what's given to me. And essentially, it really highlights the importance of our efforts and our initiative in conjunction with the provisions that my higher power provides. Bottom line is, I must have a spiritual awakening. The big book teaches us that the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. So God dependency, higher power dependency, or human dependency, my choice, my choice. Joining us this morning to share her experience with God dependency instead of human dependency is Leslie W. from, I'm going to say from Tennessee, her heart's in Tennessee, but she's also from Georgia. Oh, the places we'll go and the people we'll meet, right, Leslie? And she's a dedicated member of Overeaters Anonymous. I've known her, and she is just a wonderful, committed person to the practice and teaching of the 12 steps and 12 traditions of way of life. And she's a great demonstration for me of how one comes through adversity. So please join me in welcoming Leslie W. to the line. Good morning, Leslie. So nice to have you this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Larry. Wow. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to share my story. I was just listening to everything that you were saying, and I really could not be more thankful and grateful just to be sitting here with you, Larry, and with everyone today. My name is Leslie W. I used to live in Tennessee, but like Larry said, I'm now in Georgia. So I qualify to be in this program. I am a recovered compulsive overeater. I began my abstinence in this program in the spring of 2016. And so now I have 8 years abstinent in this program. I have lost a total of 80 pounds and have kept it off. I have a weighed and measured abstinence today, and by the grace of God, I know who I am. I know what I must do every day to arrest. And yeah, I think today what I would like to do is focus on one particular story, and I'd like to take you on a little journey with me today. this is the first time I have shared my story in this capacity. And I hope that you will just listen and that God will speak through me to touch you And I pray there's someone out there listening that whose very life might be saved by the words spoken today. Because this program does save lives. And I am 45. I have two children, two boys, ages 10 and 14. I got married young. I was 23. And I'm no longer married. And that is what this story is about, is my journey over the last year and a half. My ex-husband is an attorney. When we first got married, we moved to the New York City area where I worked. I was 23, and I had, like I said, and I had big dreams, you know. Finally had met a man that was just as ambitious as I was, and that I also felt would take care of me, protect me, provide for me. I was working in the city while he was going to law school. It was hard, but we made it through. When he graduated, I was working to support us during that time. And when he graduated, we moved to Nashville. We lived a good chunk from 2005 until, I guess it was 2012, there in Nashville. I worked in the music business, and I had bounced around between several different labels, and had started my own business at some point as well, and was still working to support myself and us, because he was still getting his career off the ground. Then it sort of, you know, the natural trajectory of life, I suppose. I felt like I wanted to have a baby. And in 2009, we decided to have a baby. And that was when my first son was born. I really was so in love with this little boy, and credit this little boy to really saving my life, because I developed postpartum after my first child was born, and also my eating disorder came in full force at that point. All I could do was eat and sleep and nurse around the clock. But I knew I had to get better. I knew something had to change. I knew I had a problem, and that was when I found Overeaters Anonymous. And I wanted to get better. Not for myself, really, but for him, because I wanted to be a better mom. You know, I wanted to be a good mom to him. And there was a lot of pressure at home, because now we were, you know, I was at home. You know, my husband really wanted me to stay at home with our baby, and that was a decision that we made together. So we began to just depend on his income, and I took a back seat. My career took a back seat to his. And I began to stay at home full time. A couple of years later, had another baby about 4 or 5 years later. And you can see how, you know, I really white knuckled it in the beginning. I wasn't truly absent. I was white knuckling it. It wasn't until after the second child was born that I really found that I found vision, that I found a vision for you on a phone meeting. I really didn't have the ability or the time to go to face-to-face meetings. My husband did not, my ex-husband was not supportive of my recovery. He never really was. So I would have to break my anonymity sometimes to tell, you know, to ask friends and neighbors to watch the baby while I went to face-to-face meetings. And it just got harder and harder, and my world seemed to get smaller and smaller. Throughout that time, no one really knew, but I was struggling under the demands of my marriage. I did what I don't really know if this is the case in other parts of the country, but for me, you know, growing up in the South, I was just taught, you know, to be a good, pleasing, and put a smile on my face and respect my elders and respect the authority in my life and the authorities in my life. And my husband was the authority in my life. I truly believed that, you know, that he was the head of a household, that he was the leader of our home, that I was to trust him. And I believed that he had my best interests at heart. There were many moments during the course of our 21 and a half year marriage where I would go to bed many nights, or I would go to bed alone. You know, was screamed at, backed into a corner. He once threw a plate of spaghetti at me. One time he got angry with me and told me to get out of the car and left me on the side of the road, and I had to walk home. Many rages, many outbursts, many temper tantrums, many moments of fear. Now, I am not going to say that I am perfect. I am an addict, and I did cause damage in this relationship. I was very self-focused, self-absorbed. I denied a lot of what was happening in front of me. I was like an ostrich, and I would stick my head in the sand, or I would plop myself down on the couch or in my bed, and I would eat, and I would hide, and I would immerse myself in television, or, you know, I would say I was sick when I was just really depressed and wanted to hide from the world. I've been hiding for a very long time. Hiding in the shadows, putting my lipstick on, walking into church, walking into social occasions, events, family events, whatever it may be, and pretending I was all right when I really wasn't. And we had a beautiful, beautiful house. We eventually moved to Knoxville, Tennessee. We were just following his work, wherever his work would lead him, whatever jobs presented themselves. You know, that's where we went. And So, you know, from New York to Nashville to Knoxville, we lived there in Knoxville for at least 10 years. And our house was a 5-bedroom, I don't know, 4,000-something square foot house with a pool and a hot tub. We were in a neighborhood where all the kids were riding their bikes, and it was like very idyllic. The ladies in the neighborhood would all have bunco on Sunday nights, and I was going to the gym and taking tennis lessons and hanging out with all the other stay-at-home moms, and, you know, life was pretty good, so I thought, taking my kids to school and volunteering and doing all of those things, you know. But I had no idea my world was about to be shattered. And in January of 2016, we went out for my birthday, a bunch of us, a bunch of our neighbors and friends. He disappeared. We were all, I don't drink. Part of my abstinence is that I don't do that. So, you know, everybody else that I'm around pretty much does. But we were in a bar and it was late and everybody was drunk, and all of a sudden my husband disappeared. I didn't know where he went. I didn't know where he was. I just was left to where, what's going, I didn't know what was happening. And I saw one of our neighbors there, one of our friends, and I was like, where did he go? And they were like, oh, he's in the bathroom, you know, smoking pot with some other guy. And I was like, or somebody, I was like, what? And I had a problem with it. You know, I did. I had a problem with it. And I'm just being really open and vulnerable and transparent this morning with all of you on this line. Because of anonymity, I do feel like I can share some of these personal things in hopes that someone else will be blessed and that will learn, and hopefully their life will be saved. Because what I wanted to say is, This was the defining moment for me. I didn't confront him right then about it because, well, I was going to therapy at the time. I knew something was not right with me. Something, I was having an issue with something in our marriage, and I didn't know what it was, you know, and in myself. And so I had started going to therapy, and I brought it up to him about a month later. It was in February, and he, I said, you know, I really am not going to go out anymore. I'm not going to go out anymore with you and get drunk or hang out with everybody and while they're doing that, because I just don't want to do that. It's not fun for me anymore. I was like, you do what you want to do. I'm like, but I don't really want to do that anymore. It's just not good for me. And I just set a boundary, and it blew up in my face. And the screaming ensued, the rage, the cursing. He threatened divorce. My kids were in the house. They heard all of it. My oldest got my youngest and put him in his room and protected him from hearing all of it. They were scared. I was scared. This time was different. this time was different than all the other times because there was a wildness in his eyes that I can't explain. And if you've ever seen it before, you know what I'm talking about. He was unhinged. When somebody's in your face and they're screaming and they're cursing and they're threatening you by saying, I'm going to divorce you, we're done. There were a lot of other things that were said that night. He blocked my way up the stairs. I couldn't go see my children. He told me to go into his office where he proceeded to say the most vile things no woman should have to hear. And then he shut the door and I was trapped in there with him. And I had to just take it until it was over. And then he handed me a document that he was working on that basically said, I will take everything from you. I will divorce you and I will take everything from you. I will take the house. I will take the kids. I will have you declared mentally unfit because of your eating addiction. I will not pay you anything. You will be destitute. He had it all written out. I didn't know what to do. It was like my life, it was like a nightmare. It didn't seem real. Over the next week, I realized that this was not a man who truly loved me. One of the greatest gifts was when I overheard him talking to someone in his office and actually telling them that he was preparing to have me committed to a mental institution because I was sick. I consulted with an attorney. Unbeknownst to me, he was reading my text messages through the iCloud. He knew where I was. He knew where I was going. He wouldn't let my mother come see me. He threatened her, told her if she came, he'd have her arrested. Every move that I made was being watched. I slept with my cell phone in the chair up against the doorknob in my room for the entire time. I didn't sleep for 8 straight days. At the end of the 8 straight days, when he got in the back, but when he got in the back seat of my car and was saying things like, you know, with my kids, you know, I was taking my kids to school. It was very menacing. It was gone. He went from screaming to, Leslie, are you okay? Why are you shaking? You seem a bit hysterical. Do you feel like you're okay to drive a car, to drive our children to school? When we get back to the house, I want you to give me all the passwords to our financial account. And it was like that. I called 911 that morning. My son, my oldest son, saw the state I was in, and he called 911 and said, I think my mom is in danger. Of course, though, you know, when you don't have, when you haven't been hit yet, you can't, the police won't really remove them. They won't, unless they say the exact words, I will kill you, or unless they hit you, you really have no recourse with the police unless you just want to file a complaint, which you can do. But what I did was I filed an order through my attorney, and I had him removed from our home. I went into hiding in a hotel with my children because that's how afraid I was of him and what he might do. A couple of days later, he did leave the house. The order was delivered. The ex parte order was delivered immediately. And for a while, things were wonderful with me, not wonderful, of course, but I didn't have contact. It was a no contact order. And the judge put the children on the order because the night that it happened, they were there and had heard it, you know, witnessed it. And I had other things on the order, other previous events, that previous things that had happened in my marriage, to show a pattern of behavior. But there were things that he did to the home, that he did to me, that he still continues to harass. Now, granted, I'm not afraid that he will physically harm me anymore. But my children, the hardest part about all of this is how my children have been alienated from me. When they started to go back to see his father, because an order can't stay in place for forever, they would come back and say things like, "Why won't you take Dad back? He loves you. He misses you. He just yelled at you. There's just that one time. Why can't you forgive him? You've ruined his life." And it went from bad to worse, because I did file for a divorce. I knew I couldn't stay with him. I did file. There was no real desire, nor would I have been able to take him back at that point after the things he had said and done. I was done. I knew I couldn't go back. It wasn't safe for me to go back. And I knew the kind of life I would have. I continued to live in that. And I refused. I refused to stay with a man who didn't love and respect me. But my children have paid the price, and pretty soon it got worse. They started coming home. My 14-year-old started spying on me, reporting back to his dad the things I was doing or not doing. I got job after job. My attorney said, "Get a job." I got a job. I got three jobs. Not hard to get it. It's not easy to get a job when you've been a stay-at-home mom for 14 years. But I did. I worked at a restaurant. Then I worked at a heating and air company. Then I got a job at their school. I got a new apartment. I did everything I could do. And pretty soon they would come home every day. Whenever I had them, you know, mediation after mediation after mediation, and it failed every time. And they would just say, we hate you. We wish we had a different mom. We wish you weren't our mom. Why have you done this to Dad? Why have you done this to our life? Why have you done this, Mom? It's like you're holding us hostage. We don't want to live with you anymore. We want to live with Dad. Why can't you just let us go? Why can't you just let us go? Why can't you just let us go? It was like this, day after day after day. And I could see that either I was being faced with an impossible choice, and that choice was to, as he refused to stay in Knoxville and he refused to get a job, there was no chance for 50-50 custody. And you can't resolve a divorce when you don't have the custody and the financial situation worked out. He had lost his job. That was really the tipping point for him when all of this started. And I didn't know it at the time, but that was what was going on. I believe that was the catalyst. So I made the hardest decision any mother could ever make, I feel, which is, you know, what do I drag my kids through a custody trial and guardian ad litem and judges and money and more money and more trauma and more court date after court date after court date. Meanwhile, they're being dragged back and forth from Tennessee to Georgia because he has no place to live and no job here in Tennessee. So they're going, these kids are waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning and they're being driven from his mother's house to Georgia back to school every Monday morning and then back there on Friday every other week, couch surfing, staying in random places, no consistency when they're with him, none, no stability. But yet that's where they want to go. They want to go with dad and live with dad at grandma's house in Georgia. So I left them. And I put a stop to it, put a stop to all the back and forth and them being used as pawns in this game. Who wins? You know, it's not, it's nobody wins in that. Nobody. So I let my children, I had the divorce papers drawn up, I had the settlement drawn up, and I agreed to let him have primary custody. I have not given up my rights to my kids, nor will I ever, but they primarily live with him, and I see them on weekends. My oldest does not want to see me. He doesn't want a relationship with me. So I mainly spend time with my 10-year-old now. I had them in therapy throughout this whole experience, and I tried everything. Nothing worked. So I had to let go and sacrifice. Put a stop to it. And they're with their dad now, primarily, and they're okay. They're settled. They've got a new house. He just bought a house. I think he just got a job. And so at least they're in one place. And for now, you know, they're okay. They're okay. They're not having to get torn back and forth anymore. I don't speak ill of their father to them. They don't know. They don't know the things that I've gone through and suffered and endured. They don't know the whole truth. Once again, I am not a perfect person. I have made my share of mistakes through this. I push buttons. Addict for rebellious by nature. So the rebel in me would, the defiance in me would come out. I would at times would silently punish my ex-husband by refusing to have sex with him or refusing to do things, certain things that I felt like I had control over. Manipulative at times. When your world is flipped upside down, and all the things you thought were true about your life are not true anymore. The man that was supposed to love and protect you and he became your enemy. You became the hunted prey. Your children that you're supposed to protect and love and care for, you find that you can't protect them anymore. And you love them. I love my children as best as I can today. But I don't drive them to school. I don't make their lunches anymore. I don't go to volunteer. I'm not, you know, I'm not room mom. My life is not that anymore. And, you know, for me, it's a complete loss of identity. I moved from Knoxville to Atlanta so that I could have a chance to be closer to them, just to spend more time with them. Instead of just once a month, maybe twice a month, no, twice a month, which I had written into my agreement that if I lived close, I could see them twice a month. My ex-husband was my God, and I think my kids were too. I think I really put all three of them in that higher power spot. Maybe not all the time, but when those things are taken, like, when you don't have those things anymore, and you don't have those people in your day-to-day life, and it's just you, then you have to depend on a higher power, or you won't make it through. My relationship, my recovery, my very life. I'm not just talking about abstinence here. I'm talking about existing. I'm talking about survival. I'm talking about breathing. I'm talking about living. It is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon my relationship with God. It says in the big book on page 100 that if we follow the dictates of a higher power, we will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what our present circumstance may be. On page 98, it says, job or no job. Some of us have had to take, some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn that job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not drinking as long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of a dependence upon God. Stay-at-home wife and mom, or no stay-at-home wife or mom, husband or no husband. children living with me or children not living with me. Not only do I not stop overeating, but I will stop living if I place my dependence upon other people ahead of my dependence upon God. God told me to run. God spoke to me that very night and said that it happened and said, this is not the kind of life I want for you, my dear child. And he rescued me from what was quickly escalating into a violent situation. I was very afraid. But today I no longer have to live in that atmosphere of walking on eggshells, never knowing when the bomb's going to go off, trying to always say the perfect thing. You know what I'm talking about? I know there's women and maybe even men out there too who know what I'm talking about. You learn to be small so they can be big. But I'm not going to be small anymore, and I'm not going to stay silent. Because I know that this has happened to me for a reason. I am surviving it for a reason. Burn the idea. Page 98, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. It goes beyond that for me. It goes from get well to stay well. Because he tried to convince me that I was crazy, that I was sick. Oh, Leslie, you're sick. You're an addict. Doesn't it say in the big book that you're physically and spiritually unwell? That you're physically, emotionally, and spiritually unwell? Not anymore. This book says we recover. We have recovered. EV, past tense. That's what it says. The only condition that I get well and stay well is that I trust in God and clean house. Well, I did. I cleaned house. I paid the price for it. But I cleaned house. And today, I have a beautiful apartment in Atlanta. I'm about 45 minutes away from my kids. I have a job that I'm doing well at. I travel. I don't know what the future holds. I miss my kids more than you could ever imagine. But I know I did what was best for them. And that's, you know, what isn't that what sacrifice is? Doing something for someone else. Love. This program is built on love and self-sacrifice. It's not easy. Not easy. Life is not easy. And we are hit sometimes and knocked down. My part is that I lived in denial. I lived in denial. And instead of facing the real truth of the circumstances, I pretended. And I really believe that that made me sick. I can't live in a false reality anymore. I can't live pretending that everything's fine when it's not. And I won't. Because I know that as bad as it has been, and as brutal as it has been, I'm omitting quite a lot of other things today, simply because for the sake of time. But it says on page 97 that helping others is the foundation stone of my recovery. And that's what I'm doing, hopefully. And sometimes it means helping myself. I have to be healthy myself. We can't transmit what we don't have. You know, we read that after every meeting, don't we? We read that, you know, we don't we can't transmit something that we haven't got. Page 153 says you're going to meet new friends in your own community near you. They're alcoholics are dying helplessly like people in a sinking ship. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. You will be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, for you will escape disaster together, and you will commence shoulder to shoulder. You will know what it means to give up yourself, that others may survive and rediscover life. You will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. If it weren't for my relationship with God and for all the things that He has done for me, I wouldn't be sitting here today. It's a miracle that I'm sitting here today. Abstinent. And not drugging or drinking or eating my way to death or locked up somewhere. Truly a miracle. And I continue to show up for my life, as hard as it is, and love the people around me, my friends and my fellows that have stood by me through this. You know who you are. You're listening right now. I mean, people that have dropped everything to come to my rescue and fed me when I couldn't even feed myself. Looked at me and said, "You're going to brush your teeth now." You're going to take a shower now. And put their hands on my chest as my whole body was shaking. And said, "It's okay. You're safe." That's not the love of God. I don't know what is it. So, dependence upon God. Not dependence upon people. We can allow people. For me, I have allowed, I have depended on people. It's not that I can't, but I can't depend on them over my relationship with God. I can't become overly dependent upon people. I can't knock God off and put another person in that spot. It's not reliable. And can even be dangerous. And detrimental to my well-being, because we're all human beings. You know, we're all very, very human. Best that we can. I think. So. You know, even my ex-husband, as sick as he is, I'm sure that was perhaps the best he could do. And now it's time for me to move on and step into whatever is next for me. It's very scary, but I know that as long as I don't shrink and shrivel up and hide, as long as I can continue to use my voice, God will speak. He will use my voice as his instrument. To speak hope. Courage and strength. To someone else. I apologize for the emotions, the emotional, the crying. It's not something I can help, so it just is. it's not easy to talk about this, but it's important to talk about it, to shed light on it, that we can overcome adversity, that we can continue on, stay abstinent, stay in a recovered state, as long as our recovery is dependent upon our relationship with God. I think that's all I'm going to share. I think that's all I have in me to share. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to let me come on the line today and be just raw and honest and transparent. It saves my life, you know, to do this. So grateful. And Larry, I think with that, I'm gonna pass. I'm gonna be done. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. You know what? I know what's next for you. Questions and answers.
What's that?
Q&A. Okay. That's what's coming next here. Leslie, for me, showing emotions is not a sign of weakness. It's rather a sign of unbridled strength. So thank you for your courageous, your transparent, heart-wrenching at times presentation this morning. And it really was a story of a shift from self-reliance, other reliance, to God-reliance, and a story of restoration and a demonstration of selflessness and strength. So I can assure you it was helpful to many, many of our fellows. So thank you, thank you. So we're now going to transition to our question and answer period. Before we do that, get ready to press star one if you have a question. Only questions only, please, for Leslie. But before we do that, let me give you the share ID for Leslie's presentation this morning. That number is 21,646. That's 21646. So if you have a question for Leslie, please press star one and give me your first name and last initial. Who has a question?
Marie R.
Marla Yetta R.
Ron G.
Roxanne
M. Amy G.
Luann. Hey, here's who I've heard so far. Yeah, let's hold off for a second here. I got Lee, but let's hold off for a second because I want to read the names that I have, and then I probably miss somebody here. Marie, Anayeta, Roz, Amy, I think it was Luann, if I heard that correctly, and Lee H.
Yes.
Did I miss someone in that first that already gave their name, not that wants to give their name, we'll get to that, but who already gave your name that I didn't mention? I believe there was another name. I heard Marie, Anayeta, Roz, Amy, Luann, Lee.
Roxanne M.
Roxanne. Okay. Well, let's go with the first group, and then we'll see if we have time for more questions after that. So we'll go in this order. We'll start with Marie, followed by Anayeta, Roz, Amy, Luann, Lee, and Roxanne. If you're not Marie, if you'd be kind enough to mute your phone. Marie, what question do you have for Leslie this morning?
Good morning. Thank you, Leslie, for sharing your story. You're not alone. You just pretty much told my story. My question is for you, is right now I'm on step 8-9, and I was wondering if you would be able to share with me how you navigated, because I know for myself, I wasn't perfect either, and I was wondering if you can share with me your 8-9 step regarding your ex-husband, if that's not too personal. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we crossed over the personal threshold about an hour ago, didn't we? So, no, it's not too personal. I don't feel that I have yet fully forgiven my ex-husband. I'll just be honest. I don't know if I am capable of fully forgiving him at this time. I can forgive the steps 8 and 9, you know, making amends. I believe that the way I look at it is the way I make amends for my part in it is that, you know, I don't speak ill of him. And that's not an easy thing to do. The way I harmed him was, I should have been honest from the get-go and said, hey, this isn't going to work for me. If this is the way our marriage is going to look, I don't want to stay in it. But I stayed for 21 years. I make amends by looking at my part in it. And my part was total and utter denial. And a lot of it, I didn't see. So, I mean, obviously, I was in an abusive relationship. And my codependency, my desire for him to, you know, protect me and be my knight in shining armor and take care of me, right? Like, I'll never forget was what complicated it. And I'll never forget him saying, I can't drag you through life, Leslie. I'm not here to drag you through life. It's like you're a burden. I always felt like I was just too much. I either felt like I was too much or not good enough for him, always. And, you know, so the greater issue is that. You know, what is it in me that caused me to feel that way and to stay with an individual that couldn't love and respect me the way that I should have been loved and respected as a woman, as a child of God, as a person, you know, the mother of his children. So today, my 8 and 9 looks like, when I have an opportunity to throw him under the bus, I don't do it. When my 14-year-old comes to me and says angrily, I want to know all the terrible things that Dad did to you to justify why you blew up or why you did, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no. God, would I love to defend myself and tell him exactly all of the nasty things that his dad has done and said. But I'm not going to do it out of respect for the fact that he is their father. So that is how I make amends. I hope that makes sense. That's it. I talk.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Bree. Okay, next, we got a question from, well, she just happens to have the most common name, first name in all of Vision, Hannah Yetta. Good morning, Hannah.
I love when you say my name. Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Leslie. Oh, my gosh. You said, is there anyone, I'm sure there's got to be somebody out there that can relate. Well, I certainly relate. I've been married 50 4 years, and I still have live in somewhat of a verbal abusive marriage. But with the help of God, I've learned how to deal with that and how to let it go. But my question, I guess, for you, there's so much I want to say. I will call you and talk to you. And it's only my opinion, but you have no reason to say you're sorry for any of your emotions. Please don't do that. Okay, so my question is, how did you love yourself through all of that abuse and all of that raging of him? And, how did you get through it with still loving yourself? That's my question.
Yeah, thank you. It's hard, you know, for me to... I behave in ways sometimes that are unloving to myself. Sometimes I do. You know, I had enough training. Someone on this line told me when it happened, they said, you know, every bite of food that was weighed, every prayer that was prayed, every meeting that was made, every phone call, prepared me for this moment. I didn't know it, but through my years of recovery, God was preparing me to leave him. I had a foundation. I had fellows in this program who said, Leslie, you're not crazy. Leslie, no one should have to live like that. Leslie, no one should have to endure that. No one should have to hear that. No one should have to, you know, that's not something that you should just take and accept. It's not acceptable behavior. Oh, I had enough people who spoke truth into my life, and I had a strong enough relationship with my higher power to know that when it was happening, the night that it was happening, I mean, I literally heard in my head one word, and it was run. That was all I heard. And I knew I had to run away from that. I knew I couldn't stay in that. Loving myself is hard today because of my children and the judgment that I receive sometimes from people who, when I say my children live with their dad, you know, like, it's really difficult. I oftentimes feel like I have to defend my position or defend my decisions to people, even my own family members. I just have to remember that I think what keeps me loving myself is knowing that God is, that this has happened, that God's going to bring it. There's going to be a purpose to my pain. There has to be. And I believe it when other people say that one day your children will know the truth and will be restored back to you. I have to hold on to that. Okay. So thanks, Larry.
Oh, you bet. Thanks, Anietta. Okay, next up we have Roz, followed by Amy, Palmdale, California. Good morning, Roz.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for your service. And Amy, your share was riveting and so heartfelt. And I would like to say I am on the other side of an abusive relationship many years. My question is, have you considered or do you utilize other 12-step programs that address these spiritual maladies? Pass.
Well, I feel like I need to just focus on OA since that's the purpose of this call. But yeah, of course, I have had to utilize outside help. You know, and it talks about, the big book talks about utilizing outside help when we have to. I'm getting some outside help right now. It's come to my attention that I need more care than I had realized. I utilize everything I can get my hands on that I think might help me. But the foundation, you know, of my life and of my recovery is, like, this is it, of Readers Anonymous. So.
Thanks, Roz. Okay, next up we have Amy, followed by, I believe it was Luann. Amy, good morning to you.
Hey, Larry, good morning. My name is Amy G. And Leslie, wow, what a story of courage.
Thanks,
and reliance on God. Just unbelievable. Amazing. So my question is, day to day, you know, you talk about this reliance on God, and this is ongoing for you. I mean, as a mother, I understand the pain, and I just appreciate your humility and your openness, because this is pain. This is life. And my question is, you know, what is it on a day-to-day basis, your reliance on God? What does that look like mm-hmm. when, mm-hmm. you know, you struggle with, you know, those issues with what you're going through with your children, for example, and the tremendous sacrifice you've made, knowing that it's the right thing to do, but that it's very painful. You know, this is about growing up in this program and doing the right thing for others and self-sacrifice. What does it look like on a daily basis? I hope it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Thank you, Amy. Thanks. Thank you for being with me on this journey, too. I think for me, when I first wake up, I have immediate symptoms. That's just part of it for me. I wake up and I'm uncomfortable and I'm afraid and I'm not going to be able to get through my day, and I'm, you know, I have residual effects from everything that has occurred. And so I'll get down on my knees and I will ask God to protect me and to hold me throughout the day and help me get through the day. I have to get up and out of my bed. I cannot stay in my bed. Reliance upon God is a writing. So I have daily structured disciplines that I incorporate into my day. I talk to a sponsor every day. That is a part of my spiritual discipline. And for me, that's me showing reliance. I weigh and measure my food. I make calls. I do those things each and every day to structure my day. I need structure. For me, God is order. God is not chaos. And so, you know, reliance upon God is not just me sitting in a room by myself and praying. Like, I have to be around other people as well. I have to be in community with other people. Like, I really have to rely on the people in this program. You know, my outside help, family or friends. And I also have to, for me, dependence upon God means that I keep putting one foot in front of the other, and I keep asking, you know, Him to show me what is it that I need to do today? Like, what is that going to look like? What is it? You know, the big book. I was just writing about this morning about how, like, my will has to be exerted among along the same lines as God's will for me. And if I feel that that's happened or if that's happening, and it's really hard to know sometimes, but I can usually know by my resistance level, like if I'm not fighting something so hard, like if I'm not resisting it so hard, like I know that God is in it because he's taking care of me. So, and the people around me, and I just say, I will tell God every day that I place my children in his hands today, and I place myself in his hands today. Because I really, my whole life is, nothing in my life is the same anymore, except for this. And so I hold on to, you know, for me, I try to be involved in a faith community. Like I try to find somewhere that I can, you know, exercise that faith with a community of other people. And so I guess it looks like a lot of different things for me on a daily basis, but I find God through that, through the structure of those things, if that makes any sense.
Makes tremendous sense to me, Leslie. Thanks for a great question, Amy. I don't know that we'll get through. In fact, we probably won't, but the good news is we'll be getting Leslie's. But next up is Luann, followed by Lee. Luann, do you have a question for Leslie?
I do. Thank you. This is Leland P. from Germany. Leslie, thank you for your share. I feel so honored to get to hear your honesty and your courage. And there's really nothing that helps me more than people who are just so brutally honest about hardship while in program. So thank you. I wanted to ask if you said, there's been so much loss and a loss of the identity, and if there was any point that you felt just utterly abandoned by God or furious at God, or just like, screw it. and if that those emotions or reactions came up, how you coped with it. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I have been really angry at times with the circumstance and why God, like asking that question, like why has God allowed this to happen? Why has God allowed my children to be, you know, somewhat estranged from me, or, you know, like divorce, these things are, there's consequences and repercussions to every decision that we make. I made the best decision I could. I made the decision that I felt was right for me and right for them. And yeah, there have been times when, especially afterwards, maybe not so much when I was going through it, but like now that the dust has settled, yeah, trying to, definitely dealing with feelings of abandonment or, you know, anger as to why, God, would you allow this to happen to me? That's always the question, isn't it? And, you know, I don't think he caused any of it. And when I look back, I have to look back at the evidence, and that helps me with my anger. I have to look back at all the things that he has done for me to provide for me and to take care of me and to get me out of that situation. You know, I have a job. I have a place to live. I have money in the bank. I have my recovery. I have friends and family that love me. I may not have everything I want, but I have, again, I don't have everything I want. You know, I don't have my children living with me like I want. I don't have a man in my life like I want. Like there's things that I have that I want that I don't have. But that's okay. because I have what I need, and God provides what I need. So that, and I just look at how far I've come. I look at everything I've overcome, and that helps me, really helps me to get past that. Because I know I couldn't have done it on my own. So with that, I pass.
Yeah, thanks so much for the question. We'll try one more. Sorry, Roxanne, but you can call Leslie. But let's go with Lee H., and let's try to wrap up with the last question. Good morning, Lee.
Well, good morning, Larry, and thank you so much for getting me in here, fitting me in. I was afraid I wasn't going to make it. Leslie, my goodness, I am so awed by your courage through all of this. What a story, and I will be calling you, too. Okay, here's my question. So many things have been answered already, but the one thing that has been hard for me, and I just want to hear how you've done it, is that just dealing, how has your higher power helped you when those emotions are so strong? And that, for me, I just feel like I'm going to die, like I don't know if I can survive these emotions. How has your higher power helped you when those emotions get so strong? That's my question.
Oh, God, that is such a great question. If I wasn't so long-winded, I could have taken more questions this morning. Brevity is not my strong suit, people. It is just not. I'm from the South. What do you expect? But, you know, I really have to say that I have felt the same exact way. Most recently, this week has been a horrible week for me emotionally. There are many days, many moments where I wake up and I do feel like I will die from the pain. God points me to outside resources to help me. And he also reminds me, like I have to say, he reminds me of what he's brought me through. Like he wouldn't bring me to it if he couldn't bring me through it. And pain is just pain. Like it comes in like a wave and then it crashes and then it recedes. What helps me is to know that it will one day it will recede. And that's what gives me hope. You know, and what saves my life is talking to other women and men too, who hear me speak or hear my voice and know, okay, like if I can get through this, you can get through this, and we can get through it together. It's being out of isolation, because those feelings and those emotions, they multiply in isolation. So that's why the foundation that I talked about earlier is so important for me. I have to have people around me to speak truth into my life and to say, you're not gonna die from the pain. But there are times where I need extra help and extra care. And that's what I have to do. It's my job to get those things that I need. So, yeah, Lee, thanks. Thank you, Larry.
Oh, thanks, Lee. Thanks for the question. And Leslie, thanks so much. I have to tell you, the measure of a woman is not what happens to her, you know, rather it's how she responds to it and how she grows from it. And what you did so beautifully this morning is how she uses that experience to empower others. And you did that for us this morning, and we're very grateful for that. I'm going to give the share ID number as we close out here for Leslie's presentation this morning again. That number is 21,646, 21646. So we are now going to close from a reading from the big book, our namesake, on page 164 in a chapter called The Vision for You. And then hang around, because we're going to, after the recording, we're going to get Leslie's contact information. So, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.